your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a fine guest this second hour. His name is Tony Gosling. My gosh, he's done so much on so many subjects. Welcome to our program, Tony.
Hi, George. Yeah, I try and concentrate on the subjects that matter. That is to say, what the mainstream media isn't telling us, or also the sort of things that are being blocked from our TV screens. I mean, I don't know what the situation is in the US, but here in Britain we're not allowed anymore to watch press TV. Unbelievable. This is a fascist kind of system, because they've taken not only the channel off of our Freeview system, which is the national digital system, which the Iranians were paying to go on there, not free, obviously, and they've also now closed down their uploads to their YouTube channel, it seems. I mean, they haven't had any new uploads to Press TV Global News, which is the YouTube channel for Press TV, for nearly 3 weeks. Well, I think it's just over 3 weeks now. One of the last uploads to there was Gordon Duff from Veterans Today talking about the Stuxnet virus and looking at the Israeli cyber war on America and Britain. So it's not surprising that some forces in this world don't want the Western public to know about certain things. I have a slot on my radio show I do every week, George, where I play something from some part of the world which is now censored, and this is the world we're living in, that the powers that be now in the Western world are actually blocking whole areas of thought and knowledge and information from the Western public.
Well, I tell you what, it's getting to be bad. Tonight, later, I'll be featuring a new book out. Adam Labor, L-E-B-O-R, has written a book entitled The Tower of Babel. You know, not Babylon, but Babel. But anyway, I know over the years you've done a lot of in-depth research in banking and so forth. And what are sort of some of your impressions, ideas, and comments on the this Tower of Babel, Adam Labor calls the International Bank of International Settlements. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, it's Tower of Basel. Basel is the pronunciation that is generally used in Europe. Now, it's called various different names, because Switzerland, of course, is a three-language country. You've got the Italian part of Switzerland, you've got the French, and the German. And they're all three are kind of quite different types of country. The Italian part of Switzerland is more, shall we say, a bit more free and easygoing. The German is very, very, very extremely super formal and incredibly, almost horribly efficient. And the French is a little bit more, like the Italian, I suppose, a little bit more relaxed. But the Tower of Basel is the organisation that now occupies that building. One of the most incredible things in Adam's book, which I'm holding here in my hand, I got a quite early review copy of it, that I realised that this is actually one of the most important things for people in the Western world to understand what's going on. This is our real government. Our governments are only elected on the sort of money that comes from party funding. Certainly in the US that's been the case for many decades. Increasingly here in Britain, our political parties are totally reliant on private and business donations to their party coffers. And where does that money all come from eventually? Originally it comes from these banks, these private banks, and which are all like little private businesses run for private profit, even though they are often controlling national currencies. And this is why the Tower of Basel, what is actually called the headquarters of the Bank for International Settlements, is such an important institution in Basel in Switzerland. And the reason for that is because this is where all of the central banks in the world meet. Now, this isn't just the West. This is many other countries as well, such as Australasia, Southeast Asia. You're talking about the Bank of Japan, all these kind of national currencies. Now, the power of this is that the national central bank in any country, here it's the Bank of England, obviously you've got the Federal Reserve in the United States, has a very, very powerful monopoly on that money. Now, you know, you can go all the way back to Jesus overturning the money changers' temples to understand this, because that's the reason he did it, because he realized that the temple tax was being paid to these money changers in the temple, and they were actually abusing the monopoly they had on these coins. So they were actually taking much more from the public that came into the temple than they should have for these coins. And this is exactly what the central banks are doing right around the Western world. They're controlling those currencies, and they meet every 2 months, and possibly more often, but that's what we know of, down in Switzerland. They get on their private jets and possibly even first-class flights down to Switzerland, and this is where they all get together, and this is where Mark Carney is a member of the board there, and he has now just taken over control of the Bank of England, as you know. But the origins of the Bank for International Settlements are fascinating. In the First World War, the war reparations, they put together the Bank for International Settlements was put together after the war to settle these debts that had been awarded against Germany. Germany's going to have to pay back for all the damage it had done during the war, and of course it was this that crippled Germany in the interwar years. Now, at the Bretton Woods Conference, just after the war, what they had is 1944, I believe, that they were all discussing, all the Western bankers were discussing what to do. We had Henry Morgenthau from the United States and Montague Norman were at the conference, various people vying to decide what was going to happen with the international financial system. And this is where these disgusting, really colonial institutions, effectively private institutions, not public institutions, were created after the Second World War, like the IMF and the World Bank. The Bank for International Settlements was supposed to have been closed down. Henry Morgenthau proposed a resolution which was passed almost unanimously through the Bretton Woods Conference to actually get rid of completely the Bank for International Settlements, and that was agreed, but it never happened. All that happened was the bank went underground. They stayed in Basel, in a chocolate shop, just next to a chocolate shop, by Basel Station in an anonymous office until the late 1970s, early 1980s, when they finally built in public this rather ugly piece of architecture called the Tower of Basel. Now, I think probably the most important aspect of this is the fact that it's, and this was revealed in Ed Adams' book, and I've never known this, I mean, it's pretty shocking, really, is that the bank itself is extraterritorial. That means it's not part of Switzerland. No one's quite sure what it is part of, but it isn't part of Switzerland, and the Swiss police are not allowed any access to it, even if a criminal runs inside to the bank. Some would say, actually, most of the people in the bank are criminals, but if a criminal from the street was to run into the bank, the police would not be able to pursue them. That's the kind of power that this bank has, George.
Well, you know, the Christian Noer, he's the present board of directors, chairman of the board of directors of the Bank for International Settlements. He said this on July 6th of this year, 2013, and he has a statement here, and this is one of the statements that I thought was really interesting. He says, number one, firstly, is finance really a dictatorship? And then he answers his own question. This question isn't new. Already, Petronius, in Roman times at the start of our modern era, asked, what use are laws when money is king? Okay? And then, if you look up that reference and really look it up in detail and track it down, it says that basically that when money is king, the laws don't operate at all. And poverty is you're useless being in poverty. There's no use, you know, whatsoever. You know, the poverty, you know, driven people have nothing to say.
Well, this is it, isn't it? I mean, essentially, what's happening in the Western world, and none of the Western media are telling us this, is we are seeing the institution of, I mean, some would call it a new world order. I actually call it just simply a plutocracy, which is just ruled by the rich people. Now, the bankers don't necessarily do the dirty work themselves. And I mean, if you have a look at, I always find it fascinating to look at the Rothschild and the Rockefeller families in all this, both big banking families now. But actually, in a way, it's more interesting to look at the Rockefeller family, because they've come from, in the space of 1.5 centuries or so, a family which was very much involved in the oil industry, to one that's realised, well, actually, the real power is in banking. So they've come a little bit, not totally, but a little bit out of oil and into the banking world. And they've made, you know, all sorts of relationships across the Atlantic with the Rothschild family. But, you know, what you can see there is a family making a transition from running a business, an ordinary business in oil, to a monopolistic business in oil. Basically, entirely, I mean, Ida Tarbell's book on Standard Oil Company is probably one of the most important historical documents anywhere in American libraries. Because what she did is she looked at exactly how capitalism was turning cancerous, effectively, where what is essentially a good system, when it works, you know, when it's done honestly and effectively, and when the banking system behind it is an honest one, it can be extremely good, and it can actually be a good incentive money for people to be creative. What the Rockefellers did, John D. Rockefeller particularly, was to really get into this whole idea of monopolising an entire industry. What you may know is what he did is he set up all these competing oil companies in order to actually spy on his real competitors. So he had companies out there, so, you know, people deliberately saying, oh, we don't know what to do about Standard Oil. What are we going to do about Standard Oil? But actually they were secretly working for Standard Oil themselves. And what he did is he managed to use those to spy on his real competitors and actually completely take over vast parts of the US market in oil. So once somebody gets control of this in a monopolistic fashion, as the Rockefeller family did, they really can set the prices. Now, that means capitalism is out of the window, of course. The price fixing, ratcheting up the price of oil, ratcheting up the part, whatever it is that you've monopolised the market in. And he also did, George, he also did this thing, vertical integration, where he was starting to own not only franchises in the oil wells themselves and obviously land in the US, which was oil rich, but he would own the drilling firms. He would also own the refining companies. He would then also secretly buy up railway companies that his competitors didn't know that he was transporting his oil for free, whereas they were having to pay for it to be transported. And then, of course, he was buying up the actual Standard Oil petrol stations themselves. Vertical integration means the entire industry, from the natural resource right the way to retail part of it, was all being owned by the same organisation. And this is the model which has now been used in banking, monopolise the industry and take control. And effectively, that is what the Bank of International Settlements is, a massive central banking cartel where they have now monopolised the entire supply of money in the whole of the Western world, including, as I said, Australasia and Japan and Southeast Asia. All the major central banks are now part of this massive cartel monopoly.
Okay, I've got a little bit better handle on this quote of Christian Neuer. He is the chairman of the board of directors of the Bank for International Settlements. He's quoting Petronius, who wrote a novel, and one of the characters says this basically: what use are laws when money is king, where poverty's helpless and can't win a thing? There's no justice in law. It's the bidding that counts, and the job of the judge is to fix the amounts. Now, here we've got the chairman of the Bank of International Settlements. It's an indictment of their own system, and he's trying to use it as some kind of a poo-poo it off or something. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what I think about that. And I also, I think you really, really understand the Bank for International Settlements is one of the only organizations which has been making some very serious and very well-aimed criticisms of the way that the people like the European Central Bank and others are dealing with the financial crisis. So these people aren't stupid, George. They want everyone, as the crisis goes through, to be pointing to the Bank for International Settlements to say, ah, well, they got it right. Actually, this is all quite deliberate confusion which is being rained on the public and disinformation. The idea is that the Bank for International Settlements will be seen as the people who are the only people that really understand it. Now, what will quite often be lost, particularly within the banking sector here, is the fact that these people are actually behind this the creation of the financial crisis in the first place, which makes it absolutely incredible that anybody in their right mind would consider that someone from the board of the BIS would be a good person to run the Bank of England. These are the people that created the crisis, George.
Yes,
and because they are, I mean, effectively, these people strut around with this kind of airs and graces walking the streets as if they're gods. I really think that they've got this into their heads, that they think they are, because they are...
That's
the ones,
it. They think they're gods.
They are the ones who could actually sort this out, but they don't, and they won't. And also, they take a very, very, I think, very disgusting and dim view of us. They see us as basically useless idiots, people who cannot understand anything, and even if they, you know, they're really insulting towards ordinary people, hard-working people. Now, the power that's going to come from this, I mean, they are obviously bringing a lot of power to themselves, not just power, but money and wealth. A lot of them is coming to, a lot of this is coming to the Rothschild family and Rockefeller family. Now, we know, George, even last year we heard around the time of the Bilderberg conference, last June, July, that the Rockefellers and the Rothschild family were setting up their own firm, basically, to scoop up a lot of these distressed assets in this financial crisis. So that companies go to the wall in Greece as whole areas. Somebody has to, for example, sell their farm for something like 1/100th of what it's worth in order to feed their family. When things like that happen, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds are there in buying it up for peanuts. And this is the way, I'm afraid, what's happening is most of the wealth, that is to say the tangible assets of the Western world, are being funneled into these people's hands. It's the biggest heist in the whole of human history. I would suggest that's what's going on with this so-called financial crisis, which, of course, is not a crisis for the rich. You know, the thousand richest people in Britain have each made in their bank accounts about £140 million each out of this crisis. So it's not a crisis for them, George. It's a crisis for us. And whether I've even heard people on the streets here in Bristol talking about this as the Nazis, the fascists. And this is people who are maybe ordinary folk here in Britain saying this is like the Germans are doing very, very well out of this. They are the most powerful country in Europe now, the biggest, most successful, and the sort of tactics that they're using on disabled people in Britain. We're seeing disabled people evicted from their homes, left in the streets because of with only their underclothes on. These are Nazi tactics, and these are the words that they're using here in Britain now.
Oh, man, I tell you. There's been some information, and I haven't verified it yet. Maybe you have come up with it, too, is that at one time, J.P. Morgan seemed to have the largest exposure in derivatives, you know. Now they're saying that Dutch Bank has overtaken the J.P. Morgan Chase Manhattan Bank in having the largest exposure in derivatives. And have you run into that lately in information?
Yes, I've seen that sort of thing. I know what's going on. I think it's important to understand what's happening here. This is economic warfare. These are economic warfare tactics which have been developed since World War II and during World War II. And they're now being used on the domestic populations. In fact, what we're seeing is the same sort of tactics. I mean, we've had here in some of our major banks cutting off bank accounts for large Somali companies that help basically get money from Britain, from Somalis working in Britain, they can send back to their families. They're now closing almost all the bank accounts of these companies. Now, what that means is starvation, impoverishment for ordinary Somali people over in Somalia. This is a economic warfare tactic. This is actually economic warfare on Somalia by the British banks, and it lines up exactly with Israeli and NATO policy against these Arab countries, George. And what worries me is this is now exactly the same kind of tactic they're using against ordinary domestic people. I'm talking particularly about the poor. You know, those are the types of people that they're using these sort of tactics against now, which is extremely worrying. And it gives you, actually, in a way, it gives you a very good indication of the kinds of characters that are now in charge. I mean, we've got politicians like Barack Obama and David Cameron who really are just simply puppets. I don't think anybody in most parts of the world, they look at these characters and they think, oh dear, what a shame, I'm glad I'm not living in those countries, because these leaders aren't really in charge at all. They're just theatrical puppets on the stage and on the television. And the only people that really believe what they're saying are the particularly naive people in Britain and America who like to believe what they see on the television. And I think possibly some of the people in the media believe it, but certainly most of the people watching don't.
Yeah, you're right. People's awareness level is different, you know, from person to person. They wake up to the real essence of reality at different rates and at different times in their lives, you know. It takes a few years before I began to really, when I was about 40 years old, I started really studying this stuff, you know. It's about 30 years ago when I started really waking up to this.
Well, it's about time that people stepped out of that comfort zone, because we really do have to face the facts. We've got a very, very serious situation on our hands. When you see a disabled person left in their underclothes outside their home being evicted because they are not, shall we say, able-bodied enough to fight their way to make enough money to survive and pay the rent, then we're in a really, really serious situation. And that is not just one of those cases. We are seeing here in Britain people committing suicide. We had a woman throw herself off a motorway bridge because the small amount of payment, something like £5 a week, that she was getting for a spare bedroom in her house was taken away by the government. Now, this is peanuts if you're looking at the wider picture of the wealth there is amongst the super wealthy. Absolutely nothing, a drop in the ocean. And the fact is that this is actually an ideological war which is being waged on ordinary people. And I think to a certain extent the idea is that they want to actually, you know, really get rid of this part of society which they see as an aberration. It's almost like we're in this sort of amongst the Teutonic Knights, where if you're not able to fight, then you're of no use to society. Now, that worries me, because it makes me think, well, possibly there's going to be war and recruitment of more people. And it's a psychological war as well on people who are weak in society, the idea that, you know, they're actually being scared into submission. And what we also have to look at, I think, is what's going on in Syria and Iran, particularly what with the... We've had loads of stuff going on over there in the last few weeks. We've had these attacks on the Syrian anti-ship missiles by the Israelis. The Israelis getting very upset about that. And now we hear that the Syrians have actually hacked into one of the most respected presenters on British television. He's Jon Snow on Channel 4 News, hacked into his blog to say that these were nuclear warheads. Now, the Syrians are starting to get rather smart with their hacking. And they're also, it's the Stuxnet virus which started all this. And now their cyber war is coming back in the opposite direction. The major news media in the West is getting its accounts hacked by Syrians or else Syrian sympathizers. And everything is edging further and further towards this war in the Middle East. Bit by bit, we're moving there. It's almost like every week we take another step closer. All eyes, I suppose, are on Damascus, particularly since we had the meeting between Putin and Prince Bandar, the intelligence chief in Saudi Arabia. And really, he was just sent over to bribe Putin, saying, well, look, we will buy loads and loads of your weapons, Vladimir Putin, if you stop supporting President Assad. And the thing is that they're treating this like it's a fiefdom and feudal kingdom. I'm afraid Vladimir Putin cannot just say yes or no to a question like that because he's actually a democratically elected president in charge of a democratic government. It's incredible that they still think in these feudal terms. And I'll tell you why that is. It's because they're backed by the banks, who effectively are now our feudal lords, overlords. These are our feudal leaders, the European Central Bank, the IMF, the World Bank, are the people we all have to doff our caps to and beg for mercy if we want to survive.
Yeah, when Christian Neuer and them, all of a sudden they float these little ideas and they think that we're going for that. But I think the body, the community of researchers, and especially like yourself, y'all are way out there and far advanced in your thinking and awareness, wouldn't you say?
Sorry, say that again, George.
I'm saying people like yourself are far out in advance of some of these people, you know, some of these leaders. They don't know how far advanced some of the researchers are in their thinking and knowledge about this whole
thing. Well, I'd like to think that, I mean, that should be the case if we have healthy...
Yeah. And you're one of the furthest in advance on getting on this stuff.
Well, I hope so. I mean, the thing is, we've got to have good analysis for our
good analysis,
our people and our politicians to make sense of the world around us. You know what? I often think that I pity people who are in a situation where they're not able to access some of these the more enlightened places online, etc. Because, you know, I can forgive someone for thinking that the world has gone crazy, George. The fact of the matter is, the world hasn't gone crazy. It's the leaders who have gone crazy.
Well,
they're punch drunk on their own greed. And also, it's almost like it's a sort of cult running things. They have absolutely no connection anymore with ordinary people. You know, Freemasonry may well come into it. Of course it might. All sorts of other cults involved. But effectively, what's going on is we've got a leadership which has completely lost touch with ordinary people in the West. And there is a problem for them, and that is that if they order the troops into battle, there are question marks over whether they'll go or not. I mean, we've seen the fascinating unfolding of the Ergenekon plot this week over in Turkey, which is just sort of a blip on the news here, a tiny blip. But what that showed was that there was this massive organisation, including newspaper editors, senior generals, hundreds of them, in the Turkish army, who had formed this organisation, a part of an organisation called Ergenekon, which is part of the origins of the Turkish people. It's from some valley that they're mythologically supposed to come from. And what's happening is that there is a backlash against this whole idea of world governance and a new world order. And so what's going on in Turkey is that there is this organisation which is designed to capture that sentiment amongst decision makers and to say, if there, you know, if there's going to be a backlash against this global governance, we are going to control that backlash. And what they were doing, Ergenekon, was blowing up bombs, killing judges, etc., within Turkey itself, and then blaming it on Islamic extremists. They were trying to create mass chaos in Turkey and in order to actually force again another military coup in the country. Now, this is the same sort of tactic that many people think has been going on in Egypt too. Certainly it's proven to be the case in Italy during the Operation Gladio in the 1970s and 1980s.
Well, I think, Tony, we've got an American Gladio operation right now.
A lot of people think that it was the Kraft Security Company that were actually behind the Boston bombing, and the reason Boston was attacked is because it was such a radical city. So, you know, if Kraft Security did that and not the Tsarnaev brothers, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they didn't do it, we'll obviously have to see what evidence comes out in the trial. And this is deadly serious. It means that you've got private security being the vector for terrorist attacks in the United States and possibly here in Britain too, with our big attack that happened in London and the 7/7 bombings back in 2005, possibly private security being the vectors for terrorism. This is pretty worrying when these private security firms themselves, they get paid, not only for doing these private security operations, but possibly getting paid by some slush fund for actually carrying out a terrorist act and then blaming it on the Muslims. But the great thing about Turkey is that they've now dealt with this. There are now hundreds and hundreds of generals and journalists behind bars who've been part of this plot to create chaos in their country and to destabilize the democratically elected government and institute a military government and a military coup.
Yeah, I wrote a piece on that. It's on my site, thesecrettruth.com, and I really went in there and drilled down in there on the Turkey situation, so I'm pretty informed about what's going on over there. There were several groups over a number of years, and that Secret Army Gladio group was an earlier group. And there was actually a sledgehammer coup plot also, in addition to the latest one. See what I mean?
Yeah, well, you see, this is interesting, isn't it, that this is concentrated on Turkey. Now, Turkey is probably the key country because, of course, it's part of NATO, but it's also Islamic. Now, isn't NATO waging a war on Islam? I thought it was. Turkey is such a key place.
Well, here's what happened was that the Young Turks were Masonic-based, and Ataturk was also Masonic-based, and they ushered in a secular government in opposition to any kind of theocracy headed up by the Muslim faith, see? And so they kept it up until about 2003 when we had a change of prime ministership over there, and that's when the General Assembly became dominated by this Muslim group, see? And that's when things started changing. They changed the Security Council over there, and that's when things started shifting somewhat away from this former secular group of officers and so forth that were Masonic-based. They have 300 lodges in Turkey today, Masonic lodges.
Well, yeah, it's quite incredible.
300.
Well, they're everywhere, George. I mean, the other thing is people need to understand is that these deists, they are actually, you know, part of their religion, once you get right into the really middle of it, is back to what we were talking about earlier, is that they think they're gods. This is how egotistical these people are. And, of course, that is also an aspect of certain parts of the way that the Abrahamic faiths have gone bad. Now, I've got a bit of a snip here from London, a fascinating new project with some of the people who worked in the banking industry are now in the process of setting up the first, as I understand it, for several hundred years, Abrahamic Bank in London. That is to say, it follows the Abrahamic banking traditions of no interest, no usury. The interesting aspect, one of the reasons I think it may be actually quite a success, is that you can actually guarantee, without any guarantees from the government or promises from the government that very few people trust, that you will actually be able to withdraw your money. I know it sounds a silly thing, but you put your money into this bank and they will not actually lend out more money than they've actually got in deposits. So the money will actually be there for you if you need to borrow it back. So they're not going to be having any leverage at all. Zero leverage in this bank. The other thing is, if you want to borrow money from them, what they're talking about doing is just charging you an administrative fee. So no interest rates that might track up or down in the future. Fascinating little idea. What they're saying is that what they want to do is to franchise it out around the UK to begin with, and then around Europe and other parts of the Western world. But we'll see how they get on with that, because these are mostly people who have actually worked within mainstream high street banking, who have seen the value of the Jewish faith, the Islamic faith, and the Christian faith's values and basically rules in banking, which have been slowly thrown out over the last 500-600 years. The idea of usury, it used to be a crime. You know, you could be locked up for charging interest in Britain under the Christian, what was the canon church laws. And it's great to see that someone thought, well, let's try that old system again. It seemed to work quite well back then.
Yeah, usury was denounced by both Plato and Aristotle as being unnatural.
Well, I mean, you can see why they do it. I mean, this is one of the reasons that...
it's a border fuel for the beast, really.
Well, it's the right reason, one of the reasons the Rockefellers got out of the banking, isn't it?
Yeah, they just start compounding interest on top of interest, and before you know it, the wealth has moved from the general population in their hands, see, over a long period of time. But Tony, I really enjoyed speaking with you this evening, and gosh, you just happen to have that review copy, too, of exactly what I was going to talk about. Well, isn't that something, isn't it?
Well, it says on the back, compelling reading, a masterly depiction of the role of the BIS in the Nazi period and the Second World War. That's Harold James, Professor of History and International Affairs at Princeton University and author of Making of the European Monetary Union. You know, this has got some fantastic endorsements, this book. It's not too thick. It's very, very readable. Adam Libor himself is a fantastic guy, and I think he's hit the nail on the head by bringing this out right now. And he shows the value of books, doesn't he? I mean, we could spend forever on the internet, but... get yourself a book, you know, spend a week reading it or a couple of days reading it or as long as you want. Read it in the bath, you know.
Right, right. Well, Charlie, do something else, man.
George, well, nice to talk to you as well. God bless and thanks very much for
having me. Tony, thank you very much for being this late this evening. I know it's late over there and everything.
Okay, so lots of love to you from here in Bristol.
Okay, thank you, sir. Yeah,
cheers,
good night.
All right, George, bye.
Well, we just can't say enough about Tony getting up really late and taking care of us from Bristol, England. And, gosh, thank you very much, Tony, for being up late. We're going to play a clip here. It's about a little over 7 minutes long. And then we're going to come back and discuss it, some of the aspects of it. It was an interview... By Matthew Valencia, the author of this book that Tony and I were discussing earlier. We just didn't have long enough with Tony, otherwise we could have played the clip during our interview with him. But anyway, we're going to play this clip. It's about 7 minutes long, and it's an interview of Matthew Valencia with The Economist, New York, with Adam Labor, concerning his book, just recently published, the Tower of Basel or Basel. So anyway, we're going to play that right now.
In New York, this is The Economist. The Bank for International Settlements was founded more than 80 years ago as a temporary institution for reparations payments after World War I. Today, the bank is central to the global financial system, and it's also a talking shop for the world's central bankers. But beyond that, little is known about what exactly the institution does, and there are also questions about its lack of accountability. I'm Matthew Valencia, a special assignments editor at The Economist. I'm joined by Adam Labore, who recently wrote a book about the BIS called Tower of Basel. Adam, the Bank for International Settlements, also known as the BIS, it's a very important institution, but it's not really very widely known or understood. Tell us a little bit about why it was founded and what it's all about, what it does.
Well, I always say the BIS is the most important bank in the world that you've almost certainly never heard of. It's the bank for central banks. It's the banks where they do their banking. So if you're a smaller central bank from a country, say, like Macedonia or a country that doesn't have great expertise in central banking, they're there to help you. The bank was set up in 1930 to manage German reparations payments for the First World War. But those ended by 1932, which meant that the BIS really could have been closed down. The bank was founded by an international treaty, and its assets are legally inviolable. It has a similar privilege to the IMF or the World Bank or an embassy. It's almost extraterritorial, and it has only 140 customers. But last year, at the end of 2012, it made a profit of more than $1 billion.
So it acts in some respects like a regular commercial or investment bank.
Yes, it's the world's only commercial bank that's protected by an international treaty.
Tell us a bit more about its role during the Second World War.
Essentially, the bank was the main point of covert contact between the Allies and the Axis powers, the Allies and the Nazis, for post-war financial planning for Europe. The two key people involved in this were Thomas McKittrick, who was the president of the bank. He was an American president from 1940 to 1946, and Per Jacobson, who was the bank's economic advisor from 1931 to 1956. What I thought was the most amazing revelation was some documents I found in the OSS archives, which show how Thomas McKittrick was cutting deals with German industrialists in 1944. He was writing to them, and he's saying, look, if you cooperate, you know, when the war's over, when we come in, we'll guarantee your profits for you. We won't decartelize you, because there was a lot of talk at that time of breaking up the giant Nazi industrial conglomerates. He said, you'll be fine as long as you stick with us. It actually says we'll guarantee your profits.
And the clouds over the BIS's reputation in more recent times, in fact, in recent years, in the past 4 or 5 years, tell us about that.
Well, the first cloud, the kind of the background one, is the secrecy of the place. You know, every 2 months, the 60 central bankers, the most leading central bankers of the world, such as Ben Bernanke and Mervyn King and Mario Draghi, meet there to talk about, you know, monetary policy and the global financial system. But we don't know anything about those meetings. They don't release any information about them. We don't have an attendance list. We don't know what themes are discussed. You know, when I raise this with the bank, they say, oh, but, and also with the bankers, like Mervyn King says, well, you know, we can't have these discussions being on the record, otherwise nobody would speak. And I say, well, look, you don't have to have the whole discussion on the record. Obviously, people need some confidentiality, but you could tell us who's there. What are the broad themes of the discussion?
Tell us a bit more about some of the more modern controversies that the bank has faced. I mean, I understand that in recent years they've faced accusations of shielding some countries' reserves from their creditors.
Yes, this is a very interesting story, which I think has quite important implications, and I think we'll eventually see some kind of change in the structure of the bank. Well, after Argentina went bust in 1991, it offered most of its creditors about 35 cents on the dollar, and about 90% of these people accepted that, but some of them didn't, and they tried to sue the bank in Switzerland, because that's where it's headquarters. But the Swiss courts, and I think also the Swiss Federal Council, have said this: the bank is founded by an international treaty. It is inviolable. It cannot be sued.
And this bank does more than we've already discussed. It's also, it has a, it's a, it's a, It's a linchpin. It has a central role in the global financial system and the global financial architecture in bank regulation and in other areas. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating things about the BIS, is that how it's continually reinvented itself. You know, there was no need for it to exist after German reparations. It should have been closed down after the Second World War for its collaboration with the Nazis. But it's always reinventing itself, and its latest incarnation is very clever. What they've done is using the bank as a place to host a lot of the new architecture of the global financial system, specifically the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, the one that has, you know, Basel 1, 2 and 3 and the 8% rule.
They set the capital adequacy ratios for banks around
the
world.
Right. Yeah. That's not part of the BIS, but it's based at the BIS, which means its service, its secretariat is there. Physically, the people meet at the BIS. The Financial Stability Board is also hosted at the BIS.
And the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, plays an absolutely crucial role, right? I mean, it's one of the central pillars of the new emerging global financial...
Absolutely, yeah. The Financial Stability Board coordinates the central banks and the regulators, you know, and that's a good thing, to try and prevent future crashes and to stop central banks going bust and to kind of oversee the whole, you know, mess of commercial banking.
So if the BIS didn't exist today, would we need to invent it? And if we did, what would we invent? Or do you think there's really no need for what they do, or at least for that to be done where it's done?
What I argue is that the bank should be democratized, that it should set up some kind of foundation, you know, like the George Soros' Open Society Institute, and issue those shares to NGOs or young businessmen or people around the world. So give them a say in how the bank is run and bring them into the AGM so that you don't have this super elite meeting all the time of people. Now, the banks, in their defense, they say that they do, you know, public work. They do training seminars, and they do bring young bankers in to central bankers to show them, you know, how the system works. But it's still a very old-fashioned setup. You know, it was set up from the 1930s, which hasn't really altered that much.
Adam, thank you very much indeed for coming in to talk to us. That was Adam Labor, author of a new book on the Bank for International Settlements called The Tower of Basel.
Okay. Boy, that was some interview, wasn't it? Gosh, that was an excellent interview. It was a little over 7 minutes long. We just had to play the whole thing because this Bank of International Settlements is a very important institution worldwide. They only have about 5 meetings or less a year, and there's about 12 men that make up the board. And they're from, Bernanke meets there and other bank head, Bank of England and so forth. And they really set the policy. And so it's a very, very important institution. I think Adam Labor is right. Labor is right. We've got to know more about this. We need much more information about what's going on there. And, I mean, these people have been ruling us virtually for decades, this whole century. So we need to look into this and really make an extraordinary effort to learn more and more about the Bank of International Settlements. You'll be able to come in to our site, and Labor, Adam, Labor, he has a site. You can go to that site now. It's www.adamlabor.com. And he's also written extensively for The Economist magazine out of UK and The Daily Telegram. And one of the articles that he wrote recently here is in The Daily Telegram, and it's entitled How How the... Never mind the Czech gold the Nazis stole. It said the Bank for International Settlements actually financed Hitler's war machine. That's the article that Adam Labor wrote on the 31st July of this year, of 2013. He said the documents reveal a shocking story. Just 6 months before Britain went to war with Nazi Germany, the Bank of England wittingly handed over 5.6 million pounds worth of gold to
Hitler, and it belonged to another country. The official history of the bank, written in 1950 but posted online for the first time on Tuesday, reveals how we betrayed Czechoslovakia, not just with the infamous Munich Agreement of September 1938, which allowed the Nazis to annex the Sudetenland, but also in London, where Montague Norman, the eccentric but ruthless governor of the Bank of England, agreed to surrender gold owned by the National Bank of Czechoslovakia. So the Czech gold was held, said, in a London, in a sub-account in the name of the Bank for International Settlements. The Basel-based bank for central banks, when the Nazis marched into Prague in March of 1939, they immediately sent armed soldiers to the offices of the National Bank. The Czech directors were ordered, on pain of death, to send two transfer requests. The first instructed the BIS to transfer 23.1 metric tons of gold from the Czechoslovakia BIS account and held at the Bank of England to the Reichsbank BIS account, also held at Threadneedle Street. The second order instructed the Bank of England to transfer almost 27 metric tons of gold held in the National Bank of Czechoslovakia's own name to the BIS gold account at the Bank of England. So anyway, this Adam LeBeau, he doesn't back off, and he tells it like it is, and it's just going to be a thrilling book. I have not received my copy yet, but I've read several reviews, and we did get to talk to Tony Gosling over in Bristol, England tonight. So that gave us additional insights into a good read on that book. We have another idea, too, another insight here. Stephen Kinzer, in conjunction with this, has just released, there's a new book out, okay, that he just effectively published just in the last few weeks, I believe, and it's about the Dulles brothers, okay? And it's going to be, my gosh, these things are breaking now, but these things are long and gone. These people have long died off, you know what I mean? And so as a result, we've got people that are outing all these people, but long after, see what I mean? They're dead and gone. So this book is about the Dulles brothers and their secret world war, it said. Yeah, I believe is the name of the title, you know. So anyway, that's something to look up. Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R, okay? And that would be something very, very insightful to look into. And it says here, the brothers John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles and their secret world war. Anyway, he's a visiting fellow with this Watson Institute now at Brown University. And it says here he teaches international relations at Brown, is an award-winning foreign correspondent who's covered more than 50 countries. I've interviewed him a couple of times, and I thought that maybe those were some of my best interviews of about anyone. But his new book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and their secret world war. And he says here, during the 1950s, when the Cold War was at its peak, two immensely powerful brothers led the United States into a series of foreign adventures whose effects are still shaking the earth, or the world, I guess he means, huh? But anyway, that was quite saying something, isn't it? And these Dulles brothers were, I mean, you know, Alan Dulles spent World War II, most of World War II, in Switzerland. And LeBeau maintains that he made deals with the Nazis over there, and they were willing in dealing with BIS Bank. Now, Adam LeBeau says that it's extra-jurisdictional. The bank itself has immunity. It was created on treaties based upon 150 different countries. And so it has immunity from prosecution. People have tried to sue the bank, but they've not been able to even, they were all dismissed because they had their own immunity and extra jurisdiction immunity. I mean, it can't be sued, supposedly, under this so-called international law that they're putting up. Christian Noyer, he's the N-O-Y-E-R, Noyer. He's the chairman of the board of directors of the Bank for International Settlements. He's also the governor of the Bank of France. And recently, he said on July 6th, he made some statements about whether or not, you know, finance is really a dictatorship. Well, he gave some examples. We have it up on our site. If you go to thesecrettruth.com, you'll be able to read the examples that we're giving there of what Noyer said and how we're actually, you know, taking that out. I mean, these people, they're not quite there with us. They're very powerful, and they control most of the finance in the world. But I believe they're a little bit behind where they think we are. They think that we're a bunch of parrots out here that can just be fed a little Polly want a cracker type thing, see, and that we're going to go away, see, and that we don't know finance, we don't know the real intrigue of what's been going on in international finance. And it is the biggest ripoff, if you want to characterize it with any one word, ripoff or a theft of our assets and through interest charging, and then creating credits that out of nowhere, and then charging interest for the credits, and then ending up with real assets of land, buildings, and cars or whatever that that we were actually originally financing. So we've got to look at finance, and we should be more careful in looking at finance. It's just like this financial crisis. Charlotte and I, we travel to Washington, D.C. in 2008. I traveled up to Toronto after that, and so forth. And we've looked at some of these other conferences. There's going to be a conference coming up in St. Petersburg in September. And so they're going to go up there and get the G20, countries together, and try to fashion a further out agreement. They have what they call Basel 1, 2, and 3, and their own Basel 3 now. And they say that these agreements are a means by which to tighten up and make the reserves and so forth and the asset loans and so forth much more banker-like versus the casino style that that was reported during the before the bank crisis. What they're good at doing also, though, is deflecting the public's insight away from the actual derivative problem, and they're deflecting that in the direction of the mortgage loan system, subprime rate scandal, and so forth that developed. In doing this, then they're able to take the tension of the public away from the real problem, which is a derivative problem. See, they were playing around pretty loose. Hedge funds today are treated differently with accounting rules than the banks at large. There were actually two methods by which to evaluate derivatives. Mark to market and mark to model were the two basic accounting methods that were accepted before this big financial crisis. And mark to market basically said that a derivative is worth whatever you can get in the marketplace. Well, some of the banks said they were holding derivatives that were very difficult for the average investor to perceive a value in the marketplace. So they said they had to come up with this mark to model, and the model was an algorithm, see. So what they were doing was they had bad derivatives on their books into the billions, into the trillions now. And they couldn't excuse those. They had to carry them on their books at some kind of a value. So they were inventing ways to do that. Later, after this financial debacle, you could say, the financial crisis, they started disallowing banks from using this mark to model, and they made them go to mark to market. Well, the hedge funds still can use those on illiquid assets. Now, I mean, they're playing they're playing a really scheme of fine semantics here. And it's hard to really understand this. It is complex, but it's complex for a reason. It's complex to try to bamboozle and to baffle the average person from perceiving to the truth of the matter. And the truth of the matter is that the Glass-Steagall Act deregulated the difference between Wall Street and banking operations. And so banks could start doing Wall Street types of transactions, and Wall Street could start doing banking operations. It created a casino type of operation. In this casino atmosphere, these banks started taking, everyone started taking really big risk in the derivative markets. They entered the derivative markets initially as a safety, like insurance, and that is not a bad idea. Just like a farmer could buy futures against his crop in case of a crop market decline, see. And that's what many smart farmers have been doing for decades in the country after the commodities markets were created. Well, the same is true with a company out there where you're having very large contracts that you might want to protect, see. And so you can enter in to these kinds of transactions that would ensure somewhat a problem that might develop. Well, it just so happened that many of the transactions that they entered into were very esoteric and very difficult to define a value for. When you have a basic underlying asset and that you're generating a futures contract of gold or silver, that's pretty well defined in determined and pretty well widely accepted, see. This new thing, though, in this derivative scams, you could say, they started inventing all kinds of different contractual agreements and option types of things that became very, very difficult, further removed from the underlying transaction. The further away that you got from the underlying transaction, then resulted in a problem of trying to define the to get back to that transaction and reconcile, and you could say close out that derivative. It got so wild that the bank started having to hold on to derivatives, and in my opinion, they're lying about the value that they're holding on to. It's into the trillions now. And some of the largest banks have some of the largest holdings. And that's what makes it especially difficult to try to tackle, to solve. I believe, after my long association with Bob Chapman and Joan Vian and talking to those people that were in the know, and both are very, very astute people. They're gone now from us. We lost them a few years ago, both Bob Chapman and Joan Vian, a couple of fine people. They dedicated to freedom and stuff. But anyway, I miss both of them. But anyway, they seem to say a Bretton Woods II type of approach. That's what Joan Vian was pushing, that idea. And I think Bob Chapman also, he concurred with that same idea. What I think finally, and I'm willing to go out on the limb a little bit and tell you what I think is going to happen out here, and I think it's going to have to happen to keep the whole shooting match from cratering altogether. And I believe that they're going to have to hold a Bretton Woods II type of conference. At that time, they'll write down, I believe, the currencies, and I believe they'll do some netting out, you know what I mean, of the derivatives markets, because they can't rely on a disruption of assets or a discontinuity of assets. But anyway, that's basically what I'm seeing right now. And I want to thank you all for listening out there. We really want to thank Tony again for coming in from Mary England. And thank you very much for listening. And we'll be back next week. Good night.